It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. By any measure, Sir Robert Swan is an amazing individual. On May 14th, 1989, Swan and his team reached the North Pole of an expedition that nearly saw them drown due to the unseasonable melting of Arctic ice. Their journey made Swan the first man to walk to both the North and South Poles. 3 years, or I should say that he walked 900 miles to the South Pole without the aid of any radio communications or backup support. Today, he works as an advocate for the protection of Antarctica and renewable energy. He is founder of 2041, a company dedicated to the preservation of the Antarctic. He is the author of the book, Antarctica 2041, My Quest to Save the Earth's Last Wilderness. And he's in Pittsburgh to take part in the EverPower Earth Day Festival in Market Square. He joins us now in our Community Broadcast Center studio. Sir Robert Swan, it's an honor to have you. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to see you, Paul.
If you have a comment or question for Robert Swan about his adventures or his current work on renewable energy, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. And what I was trying to say earlier in the introduction that I messed up was that it was 3 years between when you first went to the South Pole and then later the North Pole that you made that 900-mile journey to the South Pole without the aid of any radio communications or backup support. So we're going to talk about those adventures, but I imagine there are a lot of places, Sir Robert, that you could be spending this Earth Day. What compelled you to come to Pittsburgh?
Well, I'm very keen on history. And, you know, when you think of today's world and you think of what's got to happen, we have to have a quantum shift in so many things. And, you know, this is the center of, you know, a most amazing time in American history, you know, Carnegie Steel. And, you know, America was built really from places like Pittsburgh, you know, the oil industry in Cleveland, the, you know, the Ford guys and girls in Detroit. So if you live in America, you should come to the heart of America. And it's good to be here. And I was very graciously invited by EverPower to join with them today in Market Square. I'm coming down there. People can come and say hi to celebrate. I think it's so important that we celebrate days like Earth Day. And, you know, I have to say I'm not an explorer. I'm merely a traveler. And really why I came is that, you know, I want to get it across to especially young people that, you know, the last great exploration left on Earth is to survive on Earth. That's the deal.
You were born in Durham, England, nearly 60 years ago. Describe your formative years and what led you to become, I was going to use the word explorer, you prefer traveler. So what led you to become a traveler and an adventurer?
Well, I think that I have to say one thing, that my family had no interest at all in this. A lot of them were accountants, and I respect their work very much. But I was a historian ever since I was aged 11, and I saw, you know, these stories of this extraordinary place, the Antarctic. And I just said to myself when I was 11 that one day I would follow in the footsteps of the real explorers to the South Pole and maybe become the first person in history to walk to both poles. That was the dream. And ever since I can remember, that's all it's ever been. And I'm very lucky to have had that. I don't think many people find their dream as early as I did. It was a hell of a battle to make that dream a reality, but we did it.
So in 1984, you set out to follow in the footsteps of Robert Falcon Scott's ill-fated expedition to the South Pole. You sailed to Antarctica. And after the Antarctic winter passed, you made this 900-mile, 70-day trek to the South Pole without the aid of any radio communications or backup support, making yours the longest unassisted march in history. How difficult was this to do?
This was not the easiest thing, and everybody said that we'd die, but we believed that we could do it. And it's quite simple. Antarctic and Arctic are very simple places. They're not complicated. You get your equipment together. You find the maximum you can pull on a sled. And in our case, it was 365 pounds. And you calculate you have 80 days of food and fuel, because obviously you must have fuel to melt the snow. Otherwise, you die of dehydration. And off you go. And hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, you don't run out of food and fuel because you die in 5 days. And you march 9 hours a day, 7 days a week, 70 days in a row on skis, crossing thousands of crevasses. You sleep every night in a tent and you get on with it. But it was extremely hard. You know, I lost 69 pounds in body weight in 70 days. So it wasn't the easiest
pound a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hard. You know, and people often, some of the people who are listening are thinking, this guy must be crazy to do these things. Well, yeah, maybe one is. But, you know, when you face starvation, as I have, and you think that half the world is starving and the rest of us are trying to lose weight, you kind of ask, what is mad, you know? It was an extraordinary privilege to do it. And some people every day in the world live harder lives than I was on that journey. It was a huge privilege, and we did it together as a team of three.
Once at the pole, you received the bad news that your ship, the Southern Quest, had been crushed by pack ice and had sunk just minutes before you arrived. What followed was reportedly a lot of criticism of the adventure from scientists working in Antarctica because of the time and money that had to be spent in flying some of the party back to New Zealand. Was that criticism fair?
No, not at all, because actually we paid for it. But I do respect the fact that no one owns Antarctica. So if it's a place, a natural reserve, land for science and peace, you know, people should go there. We were lucky to go there. We were following in the footsteps of explorers from 100 years ago. And we felt very much that where the explorers started, if the United States government wanted to build a station there, well, that was their choice. We were following in the footsteps of explorers from 100 years ago. But that being said, I think it's very, very important that one respects the fact that Antarctica is a place for science and that one should not in any way get in between those scientists and their work. And I'm a great supporter of science in Antarctica. But, you know, I feel that the criticism then was reasonably unfair. We were told to abandon all of our equipment in Antarctica. We decided to say no. Why should we leave a mess in that continent? So a team of three spent another year in Antarctica. It cost me $1.2 million 28 years ago, and I'd never had a job to take another ship down, clear our rubbish, and deliver on our promises. And I think that's an important part of any exploration. Do what you say you're going to do.
3 years after reaching the South Pole, you assembled a team of eight people from seven nations for an attempt at the North Pole, and you had already done the South Pole. So what made you want to attempt the North Pole?
Well, quite honestly, if you've got a debt of $1.2 million, and that's a stack load of money today, and it was a real lot of money 28 years ago, one of the ways I thought, being rather stupid, that I could maybe expedite paying the debt off was to make another expedition. So it was debt paying, but also I'd always dreamed of being that first person in history to walk to both poles. And Paul, I have to be honest, when I started this, I had no care for the environment. I thought somebody else would be dealing with looking after our world. I went to both poles, and I'm not embarrassed to say, because it went down well with girls at parties. It was part of history, and maybe I was making a tiny bit of history myself. It was all very selfish, and it was from those expeditions that hopefully we've tried to build a much better reason for having done these things.
Well, your team nearly drowned during the expedition to the North Pole due to unseasonable melting of Arctic ice. Describe that near-death experience.
Well, the North Pole is a frozen ocean. South Pole is ice on land. So when you're walking to the North Pole, you're walking every step away from the safety of land, 700 miles from the safety of land. So every step is into danger. And one expected, because that's what we were told, that's what the records told us, that the ice at the North Pole melts in the month of August. So it was just a bit of a shock that it melted 4 months, 25 years ago, 4 months before it ever had. And we were 600 miles from the nearest land, and the entire ocean broke up beneath our feet. And we, you know, are British led, remember, so we don't have a CNN camera crew filming us, and we don't have a submarine there just in case we might get our feet wet. So we had a massive fight to stay alive. It was without doubt the most frightening experience, and it really impacted me to take these issues that we face incredibly seriously, because they are a survival issue. The places I go to, the North and South Pole, are ice. And if you have ice and it's 32, 33 degrees, it stays as ice. At 34 degrees, it melts. Simple as that. And these places, 25 years ago, said something to me. And since that day, I've tried my best to be as positive as I can on that issue of survival here on Earth for us.
How much did that episode drive home the point for you that the Arctic ice is rapidly disappearing? And how much did that inform your commitment to drawing attention to the problem of global warming?
Well, I think it was a rude shock. You know, when I walked to the South Pole, I walked under a hole in the ozone layer and my face burnt off and my eyes burnt out. That was a bit of a shock. And then the North Pole, the ice caps melt. So you kind of overcome that moment of thinking that somebody else is going to be doing this problem. I believe that's part of the issue that we all face on Earth Day, is some people still think that this is somebody else's problem. It's not, it's ours. And those experiences at both poles gave me a really big kick in the backside to say, right, Rob, what are you going to do about this?
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Sir Robert Swan. He is the first man to walk to both the North and South Poles, and he has dedicated his life to the protection of Antarctica and renewable energy. If you have a comment or question for him, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Kurt in the South Hills. Kurt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Sir Robert Swan.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, thank you.
I was wondering how traveling through wilderness changed your perception of the world.
Hi, Kurt. Good question. I think that two things. One is you realize that actually we, the human race, tend to feel that we can dominate the wilderness, dominate our planet. But when you've walked to the South Pole or the North Pole, you know how small we really are, how insignificant we really are, and how our world is a hell of a lot more powerful. And if we carry on as we are, it'll just spit us out. So you just get that real sense of feeling quite small, quite vulnerable, and certainly not arrogant.
Kurt, thank you. Appreciate that. 412-246-2002. The number to call, and the email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Sir Robert Swan. What is your reaction when you hear people deny that global warming is happening? And I'm hearing from some that global warming isn't even the politically correct thing to say anymore, that we should say climate change, but really it's about global warming, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think it's a really, you've got to be really positive about it. That's the point. And maybe some people on one side of the fence have gone a bit too far and maybe been a bit too dramatic about climate change and global warming. And then, as you say, there are other people who say it doesn't exist.
When you say somebody's been too dramatic, what would be an example of that?
Well, I think that people, you know, have frightened people. No one wants to be frightened. No one is inspired by negative. So I think it's really important, because negative does not create action. People just freeze. They just say, I can't do anything about this. I'm too small. It's all too much. Let's move on. So I answer the question very, very simply. I mean, 10 days ago, I was in Antarctica. We were in the hottest day that's ever been recorded in Antarctica, 64 degrees Fahrenheit. That was just stunningly hard-hitting to us. But I answer it very simply by saying this. I am not an explorer. I'm not an environmentalist. I'm not a scientist, Paul. Do you know what I am? I'm really good at staying alive. I'm a good survivor.
Clearly. Okay. Clearly right. You're good at that.
And if you're good at surviving, how do you survive? You don't see a perceived threat and do nothing about it. You don't just look at a problem and say, whatever. You deal with that problem just in case it is a threat. So my view to the people who say it isn't happening, I answer that by saying climate change is happening. Science has confirmed it's happening. It could be part of a natural cycle. It's not definite yet. It will happen quite soon that science across the board will tell us we are 7 billion of us causing this problem. You and I kind of know it's happening, but it's not been ticked off yet. So what you say to those people is, look, it's an insurance job. If there is a perceived threat, for goodness sake, let's do the right thing about that perceived threat just in case it hits us. And if we don't, we're asking for trouble. So do the right thing. And I know you've got some great guests coming in later from, you know, the Chatham University here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, those are the people that talk sense. It's got to be a business opportunity, otherwise it won't last. So to the people who say no, you say, look, what happens if it is? Let's do the right thing just in case. Within a few years' time, I'm sad to say that science will confirm that it is happening.
Well, you've seen the evidence. You've seen it. The polar ice caps are melting, and I've seen it on film, but you've seen it with your own eyes.
Yeah, I've stood on it and nearly died. Now, people could say, well, isn't that just part of a natural cycle? It doesn't matter anymore if it is, because it is happening and we need to act and take business. You know, as I was saying, you know, the new business of this area after steel and oil and cars in Detroit, you know, it will be environment. And, you know, whatever power who've invited me here today to come down to Market Square and share the story between 11 and 8 o'clock today, what they're all about is the future of business. They've got to make a successful business out of renewable energy, and that will help. It's time that we moved on from a debate and got on with it.
We have people that are waiting to talk with you. Again, our guest here on Essential Pittsburgh, Sir Robert Swan, the first man, the first human being to walk to both the North and South Poles, because it could have been a woman. It happened
Absolutely.
To be a man, the Absolutely. Man sitting across from me, and people are waiting to speak with you, Sir Robert. So let's go first to Leela, who is a professor at the Community College of Allegheny County. Welcome, Leela.
Community College of Allegheny County. I just gave a presentation yesterday at my college on my fabulous journey to astounding Antarctica, the last and final frontier. I was there during December, which is summer there, at the invitation of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And we had wonderful lectures from scientists there as to how they are trying to preserve the environment. The ozone hole was detected in Antarctica, and they brought about policies in various countries to stop putting CFCs into the ocean so that the ozone layer can be recovered. And there are signs now that the ozone hole is shrinking, so that is a good sign. So, I'm just making a comment that the scientific research going on at Antarctica is fabulous, and we were all informed about the various science that's going on, right from biology, chemistry, geology, glaciology, physics, and it's really a fascinating place, and I would advise as many people to go and visit Antarctica as possible. Thank you, sir.
So, Leela, before you hang up, so you just got back from Antarctica. How recently were you there?
I was there from December 19th to December 28th, 2014.
Oh, okay. And so just a few months back. And this was a research expedition.
Yes, scientific expedition. I was there at the invitation of the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Well, it's fantastic.
And the selection was based on our scientific research experience and our knowledge and our teaching experience.
Well,
since
I
have more than 50 years of teaching experience and research experience, I was one of the invited guests by the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
That's wonderful, Leela, and Sir Robert would like to chime
well,
in.
Well, I think that what you experienced, and well done you, is that Antarctica must remain a natural reserve land for science and peace, because as you know, Leela, Antarctica may be is the place that can answer some of these questions about climate change, global warming, ozone depletion, many of those issues. So I wish you all the very, very best of luck, and well done you for going. Hats off to you.
Thank you, Leela. Let's go to Noel in either Noel or Noel in Pleasant Hills. I'm going to say Noel. Hi, Noel.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on air.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us.
So I just recently graduated from the University of Pittsburgh with a civil engineering degree, and I want to know, you know, what are some things that I can do to help with all these issues with running out of drinking water and with the ozone depletion and all this global warming?
Well, I think that it's fantastic. Congratulations on graduating. As an engineer, you know, it's technology and engineering that will make sure we can survive as a species here on planet Earth. So my suggestion is that you join a really good engineering company and start to look at how we can, you know, make sure we've got drinking water, make sure that we're engineering our way out of this problem. And, you know, put it on your list, join a company, and then make sure that doing all these things is seen as a business opportunity for that company, because that is the only way that you'll inspire business to be doing the right thing. So I wish you all the very, very best of luck with your career. Engineer, help engineer our way out of this.
Thank you, Noel. And be sure to stay tuned to the rest of the program, because we're going to talk to you about some of those opportunities that are available. We need to go to break and wrap this up shortly. But Sir Robert, before I let you go, I wanted to mention something you did in 2008. You and a small team, powered entirely by renewable energy, lived and sent broadcasts from an e-base via the internet for 2 weeks. It was the first time in history that a team had attempted to survive in Antarctica, relying solely on renewable energy, and the mission was successful. What kind of statement does this event make about renewable energy?
Well, I think that the one way to preserve Antarctica, which I hope we will do in the year 2041, that's when the debate, you know, do we destroy it, do we go and exploit it, starts, is that if we're using more renewable energy here in the real world, then it won't make financial sense to go and exploit Antarctica. It's a long way away. It'll be very hostile, very expensive to do it. So I'm actually a renewable energy champion for two reasons. One is to help preserve Antarctica in the future. One is that we really need to be doing that here on planet, you know, back in the real world. And that's why I'm proud to work with companies like EverPower, because they're doing it. Now, we survived in Antarctica only on renewable energy. But, Paul, we're stepping it up one last time, is that in 2015, 2016, I'm going back to the South Pole. You're an old man in my business at 35. I'm going to be 60. My son, who's 20, Barney, is joining us. And we are making a journey of 1,000 miles on foot in Antarctica, pioneering the use of renewable energy for our survival, right where it's down to how do we melt our snow and ice to drink? How do we cook? No one's ever dared do that. I'm up to do it because I think it's really important that we inspire people on this issue, and people need inspiring stories so they can say, hey, if that lunatic can do that, maybe we could do something too.
That certainly is an inspiring story. Our guest has been Sir Robert Swan. He is the first man to walk to both the North and South Poles. And as you just heard him say, he's going back to the South Pole. And he is in Pittsburgh, taking part in the EverPower Earth Day Festival in Market Square, so you can join him there later today. In the meantime, Sir Robert, it has been an honor to meet you. I must say, you may be pushing 60, but you look like you're in great shape, sir. So thank you again so much for being with
us. And good luck with your marathon. Good luck to your team who are relaying it. Don't get too cold. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Coming up, we'll hear about Chatham University's new one-of-a-kind green campus. It's a Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Chatham University's Eden Hall campus is more than a 388-acre plot of land. It's home to Chatham's Falk School of Sustainability and Function, a living and learning laboratory where the campus just doesn't house classrooms, but is the classroom. It's the first in the world of its kind, and joining us to talk about it is Dr. Tom Macagno, Assistant Professor of Sustainability and Business in the Falk School of Sustainability. Dr. Macagno, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's great to be here on Earth Day.
What sets Eden Hall apart from other university campuses?
For me, I think what it is that Chatham University is actually walking the talk. That's what attracted me to come to Chatham, that they're putting in practice what a sustainable campus should look like. For example, we have net zero energy. So we're producing all of our energy that we'll use on campus, on site. That's coming from solar energy, from geothermal. At the same time that our buildings, the new ones that are being built, are LEED Platinum. So in a sense, we're walking the walk, if you will.
If you'd like to join our conversation, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. So what entices students to attend Eden Hall? Are young people today sold on this idea of sustainability, renewable energy? Are they buying into this and flocking to the campus, or are they maybe a little more skeptical and need to be educated about the importance of this?
I think that young people are very excited about sustainability. Obviously, there's lots of competing programs out there. What we really offer is for a chance for students to get hands-on experience. So, for example, that one of my favorite parts is our aquaculture connects to the greenhouse that's there. And so that effectively the fish poo acts as a fertilizer for the greenhouse. So we're creating complete systems. And students, what's significant about that is they get to see firsthand how these systems work. They get to work on them. And ideally, they're going to take this back into, I don't want to say the real world, but back into practice when they leave the university.
Well, and when you say real world, by the way, I love the very scientific term fish poo, which is probably the first time we've ever heard that on this show. But, you sort of stopped yourself there when you were talking about the real world. But the reality is that we are the rest of the culture, for whatever reason, has not bought into the sustainable, certainly not the renewable energy values that, at least in this little corner of the world, on the Eden Hall campus of Chatham University, you clearly have.
And what we're trying to do is just ingrain this as part of the student's experience, give them the hands-on experience with that. I think a lot of them are already convinced when they come, but they're trying to see, it's like, how can they take that back and work for companies or work for themselves and transfer that knowledge? I think also that the generation that's up and coming, the millennials, if you will, and the generation after that, that they're looking for more from work than just a salary. They're looking for meaning, and that we're trying to help them identify what that is. And they identify, it's like that coal, that fracking has its limitations, and that we need to look at transitioning away from there.
So what does a bachelor and master degree of master's degree of sustainability allow the bearer to pursue? How are these degrees going to be used in the workforce?
There are really two broad ways you can look at careers in sustainability. There'll be ones that are specific, meaning that you have sustainability in your title, and there'll be others that are sustainability just in a job. And some of our graduates, for example, work as university coordinators. A recent graduate has pulled together funding and is starting a food truck, a grocery truck for in the Pittsburgh area. So it's this idea of giving access to local communities for food. So that's on the nonprofit side. We have others that work on nonprofits and also on incubators, innovation incubators. So there's a lot of different areas you can pursue. Like any career, what you need to do is set out a path for yourself. So just because you graduate, you know, with an engineering degree or a sustainability degree doesn't mean you'll go, but you need to have those opportunities and map them. And that's what we try to do, is to set out. For instance, students can, in our food studies program, they get exposed to making chocolate. Likewise, they get exposed to product development of for different food items. So they can map out a path through that. And in the Masters of Sustainability, we also offer that as a dual degree with the MBA. So what I particularly like about that program is you get all of the sustainability background, but you get a very classic and traditional MBA offering that the market readily recognizes. So when you apply for a job, you don't need to explain. They get it, and they get somebody that has a sustainability background.
And are there any other programs like this in the country or even in the world?
There are programs that have elements around the country. I think really what we're doing well at it is combining everything in one place. So we have the Eaton Hall campus, again, with the cutting-edge technology. We, for instance, we're processing our own wastewater and stormwater on site. Students get exposed to renewables. Students can grow crops there themselves. At the same time, we're giving what you would expect from an education, the skills for them to interpret data, to work with data, to work with people. And we're trying to instill this idea of thinking of sustainability as a system, or thinking of activities as a system, where traditionally we haven't thought of a system. We've thought of one-offs, like, oh, I'm going to go dig something out of the ground and make money off of it, and I'm not going to think about how the consequences are. But our students hopefully will leave and they'll see a bigger picture and see it's like, okay, we can recycle this and look at the whole life cycle.
We're talking with Dr. Tom Macagno, Assistant Professor of Sustainability and Business in the Falk School of Sustainability. It's part of Chatham University's Eaton Hall campus. You can join the conversation with a comment or question at 412-246-2002. And how does the campus maintain its zero waste status? Is it reliant on the maintenance of its facilities, or do students just have to be as eco-conscious for it to stay completely waste-free?
Well, in zero, we're zero net energy. We're using our energy, and in a sense that we're processing our water, but in actual solid waste that we compost, we are not reaching solid waste net zero on that. But we have composting set up to take care of our food waste, and of course we do recycling.
Has the creation of the campus allowed for new jobs to be created, especially since the campus is so specialized?
Some might say my job as a result of that. Plus, we've hired different faculty and staff to support that. Plus, I think we're doing a lot of outreach in the region, and that there'll be spillover there. Likewise, we're looking at having closer cooperation with the farming community and entrepreneurs in the community. So I think there'll also be a spinoff there.
And what does a green university do for the green economy?
Ultimately, turning out the students with the skills and the mindset to take the green economy forward.
What does it mean for private organizations such as universities to be ecologically minded? Is this, as you set this example, what are you hoping that other organizations and universities might do in terms of following in Chatham's footsteps?
Again, thinking about many make very good progress now, to give credit where credit's due. One would hope that they would integrate their different programs in with a sustainability component. That's one of the things unique we're doing across Chatham University, not just sustainability. Each student in undergrad will have to take what's called the Eaton Hall experience. So they'll get actually exposed to hands-on sustainability experience. That could be from studying ecological economics in the forest that we have around or the woods that we have around, or it could be done in another way in raising animals. So each part of the university is designing the course that will best fit their students. So again, integrating it across the curriculum.
So you're saying that this isn't necessarily a template. It's a start, and some people may have their own ideas to add to this concept of a green college campus or a green university.
Definitely. And I think that's really a big message that comes across, that everyone has a slight different view of what sustainability is. What I think we're doing particularly well is trying to play a leadership role and a bit of entrepreneurial role and really set out and see how far we can go and how far we can take it. And if others follow us or do something different, that's fantastic. Ultimately, we're all trying to reach the same goal.
We recently spoke with a contractor who says a lot of his clients living in historic homes would like to make green updates to their properties. However, one of the challenges he runs into is people not wanting to destroy the historic integrity of their home. What about that?
There's lots of ways around this. I know this firsthand because the last 11 years I lived in the UK. And there's lots of historic buildings and homes there. And we can learn a lot firsthand just from there. There's ways of retrofitting properties so you don't have to destroy their character and historic aspects.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation to find out about what's happening at Chatham University's Eden Hall campus. And again, it's 388 acres of land where the campus doesn't just house classrooms, but it is the classroom, and it is the first of its kind in the world. We've been talking about it with Dr. Tom McCagno. He's the Assistant Professor of Sustainability and Business in the Falk School of Sustainability. Dr. McCagno, thank you so much for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, does all the news regarding climate change have to be bad? We'll talk with Communitopia's Joylette Portlock. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today marks the 45th anniversary of the first Earth Day. It was begun at a time when the war in Vietnam raged on, student unrest was taking place at college campuses, and pollution was commonly accepted. Since then, the world has become more environmentally conscious. However, from melting ice caps to carbon emissions, how do we encourage people to do something about the environment without painting a picture of gloom and doom? We're posing that question to Joylette Portlock. She's president of Communitopia, which is dedicated to positive environmental engagement. Joylette Portlock, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. Happy Earth Day.
Yes, and a happy Earth Day to you too and to everybody listening. Earlier, we had Sir Robert Swan here with us, and you might have heard him mention the idea that, you know, he sort of is buying into your theory here, that you can't, it can't all be about gloom and doom. It can't all be about if we don't do this, X is going to happen. You can't threaten people into taking action, apparently, can you?
No, you can't. And it makes sense, too. I mean, but research has even shown that all negative, all the time approach is counterproductive in many ways. And, you know, I say this so often, it's become my catchphrase, but you can't depress people into action. That's just not how human beings work. You know, we need to feel hope and we need to feel enthusiasm. And I think that there's the potential for that here. We just don't commonly get it.
So how do you inspire people? You know, we earlier in the show, we talked with a man who, you know, walked to both poles and who, because of his firsthand knowledge, has been inspired to act. And his actions are clearly going to inspire others. But there are these things, you know, we just celebrated the fifth anniversary of the big Gulf oil spill and the 5-year anniversary. And, you know, we're having all this strange weather. You could maybe today could be considered a strange weather day. So, you know, in the midst of all of these events, these problems, the, you know, the ways in which we're seeing that the environment is strange and being harmed by us. Mm-hmm. How do we snap out of it, Joylette?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's so much a matter of snapping out of it as it is extending that conversation. So sometimes, you know, if you look at just the effects that we're seeing from man-made climate change, about which the, you know, scientific evidence is impossibly strong, and, you know, the world scientists have stated this is unequivocally happening because of people. And the effects are also very drastic and in many cases dire. But I think the conversation has to go beyond that. Really, while worrying about it is important, it's also, like I said a little while ago, it's hope and it's enthusiasm that you need for action. So what we try to do is we don't, you know, sugarcoat the impacts of climate change, but we work to engage and empower people through humor and by giving people tools and ways to really engage and act. We really work to get people to see themselves as part of the solution, to understand that, you know, this is a high drama situation, but, you know, we can be the heroes that save the day.
And you and we've
and
played,
we need to be.
Oh, absolutely. We've played excerpts of the videos that you've done. You are a very creative person, and I think we can probably link or have linked from our website at WESA.FM to some of your work. Joylette's productions, her short films and animated messages and all of that are available online. You can check them out, and you can it's really impossible just in this short segment to convey just how creative and humorous you are. But can you give us an example of how you would take a serious subject? Let's say, you know, let's talk about global warming. All right. Now,
just for instance,
how do you lighten up, you know, the idea of, hey, the Antarctica is melting, the ice caps are melting, the temperatures are rising, it's creating more moisture, and we're having all these horrendous storms, but by golly, you can do something about it.
Right.
Because if anybody can create that message, it's you.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's multiple tactics to take. I mean, humor is tricky, but, you know, you can try to, you can always do gallows humor, kind of like we're all in this and wow, you know, this is, you know, not so great. Just make fun of the badness of the situation or the unfortunate situation. You can also, you know, use goofy humor and puns, and we do that a lot too. And you can also, you know,
can you give me an example of that? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Well, if you watch we did an episode on ocean acidification, which last summer, which is something that people don't know a whole lot about, or even realize is happening as a result of carbon pollution, creating carbonic acid in the oceans. But, you know, that episode, these are dire impacts, but the whole episode is just a case study in water puns. I mean, it's from the oyster farmers that are having trouble staying afloat to the, you know, to the, you know, what have you. So, you know, we do have a lot of fun with it. And also there are usually opportunities to sort of, you know, make fun of ourselves for, you know, how we're either not acting, even though things are obvious, and, you know, make fun of some of the things that are, you know, obstacles. So, you know, we try to have a good time with it. I think what's important is that we remember that, you know, no one wants to envision a future where, you know, we can't laugh and where we can't have fun and where there's nothing to enjoy. You know, we want to paint that picture for people that, you know, we can improve the situation and we can laugh along the way.
We're talking with Joylette Portlock. She's president of Communitopia, which is dedicated to positive environmental engagement. And she's also involved with something this weekend called Future Fest, which we'll get into. But what is the latest news regarding climate change that people are not aware of? I mean, we've heard enough about the oil spills, the rising temperatures, the harm that the environment is sustaining. But there are other things that people may not know about. What should they know about?
Well, So you mentioned, you know, obviously oil spills, oil train explosions that are happening as we use dirty oil from the Canadian tar sands and try to ship it. It's very volatile. So we have some of that happening. Policy-wise, we actually have a lot of, I would say, good news happening, developing. The U.S. government has, you know, entered into some agreements, or at least President Obama has made some agreements with the international leaders of China and India to draw down our carbon pollution over the next several years. And this is leading up to international negotiations in Paris later this year, which are, you know, I think for the first time in many years, you know, people are looking towards those international negotiations with a more hopeful eye. But, you know, it's all happening in the context of, you know, you talk about Antarctica, which had, you know, the highest ever recorded temperature there, you know, 10 days ago, 60 some degrees in Antarctica, and 2014 was the hottest year on record, which sounds crazy maybe to people who live here, but the northeastern United States was pretty much the only cold place on the planet for 2014. It was the only cooler than average area. So, you know, we've got, we definitely do have some challenges, but we also do have clean energy, you know, on the rise. And by doing that transition, we can not just create a stable climate, but also get the other environmental benefits of cleaner air, cleaner water, too.
So that might be the answer to the question I was going to ask about, how do you encourage people to do something about the environment without painting a dire portrait? Because a lot of times we're not spurred to act until, you know, we hear some dire warning. You know, mm-hmm. we wait till the last minute, and then when things appear to be as bad as they can be, then we act. So it sounds like
the old saying, if it weren't for the last second, nothing would ever get done.
Right. Exactly. So it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, there are positive things. There are positive results of making changes in just, you know, recycling and how we use our own energy that, you know, people can be spurred to action with, just because, hey, this will make life better for all of us.
Yeah. And I think that's really the message, is that, you know, the news is dire, but it's really about taking the conversation beyond that point and saying, OK, well, what do we do? Because where the hopelessness comes from is that lack of empowerment.
Your organization, Communitopia, is taking part in an event called Future Fest 2015 this weekend. Would you give us a preview?
Sure. Future Fest is going to be great. We are spearheading this event with dozens of great other organizations. It's going to be held on the front lawn of Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday. And it is just going to be a great all-ages free event. It's all about helping people envision that clean energy future. So one thing that, you know, has been done a lot is painting sort of the picture of, you know, the ice caps melting and everything is on fire and sea levels have risen and everything is awful. We want to sort of take the other side of that and say, well, look, if we, you know, make these changes, then we can have a great future, and helping people see what that looks like. So we're going to have music performances from local bands. We're going to have food, hands-on activities. We're going to have solar aquaponics demonstrations. We talked about aquaponics in the last segment with Chatham. We're going to have electric vehicles. You can take e-bikes for a test ride. And we're going to be premiering our newest music video parody at the event as well. So part of our video work. Well, so it's going to be great.
We'll look forward to that. And again, that's Saturday at the Phipps. It's the Future Fest 2015, and our guest, Joylette Portlock, is very much involved with that. Joining us here in Studio A, Joylette, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day back to you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.